The whole industry is a melting pot for insecurity, I think. That doesn't go just because you're sober. I still feel a lot of anxiety. That doesn't go. You just have tools now with which to cope, and healthy tools with which to cope.
Welcome back to the fresh new fashion season of This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfor. Over the next 6 episodes, we are casting the spotlight on the fashion industry. Yes, that's right. We are going to undress and reveal to you what it is actually like behind the scenes. In this first episode, we are delighted to welcome onto the show celebrity stylist Holly, who's worked with likes of Tiny Temper, Bill Nighy, actor Christoph Waltz, and of course, moi. Holly's career in fashion began with an internship at just the age of 16, after which she worked her way through the ranks at GQ, ending up as a fashion editor of a popular men's magazine. Growing up in the idyllic English countryside, Holly reflects on early panic attacks, paints a powerful picture for young women who might worry about what a social life looks like without alcohol, and reveals what it is that a stylist actually does. Holly, welcome to This Is Powerful.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking your time to come here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
More than welcome. We did a funny intro because we worked before together, which is a very nice experience, actually.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I don't know about you.
Definitely. We've done a few shoots together.
We have indeed.
We have.
So this is our fashion season, and we're very privileged to have you on here. Huge celebrity stylist. Been editors of magazines and worked in GQ for many years. And it's about sobriety, addiction and recovery, obviously. I'd love to know where you're from and how was your upbringing?
How long do you have?
We have hours.
I was in London as a little kid until maybe like 4 years old, and my family moved out to the countryside, which is where they've been in the same house for 30 plus years. It's a funny one. We're a perfect family of four.
Yeah.
Very loving. A lot of privilege. But my father in that setup is actually my stepfather. And my brother in that setup is actually my stepbrother. So sort of we were like a blended family, I think they call it now. My real father left my mum and I when I was a baby. And I saw him a bit, and then he moved to America, and he actually passed away when I was 21. And that's a whole other thing. And then my stepfather, who I call my father and brother, his mother really sadly died when he was a baby. But our parents had known each other since they were kids. They had gone out. So it's all quite romantic, I guess, that they found their way back to each other.
Yeah.
So I think whilst there was like, I had a really lovely childhood in a really beautiful village. We went to really good schools, very sociable. All the rest of it had like, we didn't want for anything. We had great hobbies. But behind all of that, there was like a lot of sadness and loss.
Yeah. And because of your father, probably.
Yeah. And, you know, my brother lost his mother and as a child, like, I can't even imagine. And I didn't really know my father and had this very complicated relationship with him and backwards and forwards. And there is no blame to my parents here. Like, we had such a lovely upbringing, but things were not talked about. And I've like spoken to my mum about this recently. You know, there was, our parents were just not meant, my brother's real mother, my real father, they just weren't mentioned. And it was that real like old school British, like sweep it under the carpet. We're a family of four. Let's go kind of thing. So,
do you know what? It has logic. We talk about that quite often because I had that with my dad. He's very, very, very Victorian in that way. And still today at 86, he will say, well, we don't talk about those things, do we? And I will ask him a question. Well, how's your friend? What's going on there? Well, you know, I wouldn't have asked that question. And I sit there sometimes and think, well, what do you talk about? What goes on?
Yeah.
But I understand as well, because actually I've learned that you don't say certain things in certain situations as well, in a healthy way. So there's another side to it, which I've learned as well. But he will never change. You can't change him. That's his thing.
Yeah, completely. My father, stepfather, but let's say father for this, is so old school. And there is no changing him. And like, I remember when I was in therapy when I was a teenager, and he had to pick me up once. And I remember dreading it because there was a snowstorm. He didn't want me to drive there. And I was like dreading it because it was just so uncomfortable. And the fact I was in therapy was like a bit taboo and like da da da. And he picked me up and was like, "So, how was the quack?" And I was just like, "Oh, like, this is so uncomfortable." And like, do you know what I mean? Like, that's, yeah. He will always be like that. And I love him for it. And like, each their own. You can't change people.
No, and I, to be honest, now things are getting completely the other way. I kind of like characters more and more like that. I'm gravitating towards that more myself, actually, as a father. Not that we don't share. So with my daughters, I'll sit on the floor with them, look them eye to eye. But also we don't dramatise things or make things too much. Yeah. It's finding that fine line. How was your mum to talk about?
That conversation that, recently. Yeah. She was, it was really nice. I feel like our relationship, especially since I've been sober, has like found a new depth. We've always been incredibly close, potentially too close at times, like maybe there's like a little codependency like running through there. But because I didn't have a great relationship with my stepfather to begin with, or my stepbrother, until maybe I was like 16. So it was like a long time of like not getting on but particularly well with these two men in my home. And my mum and I are like unbelievably close. And she always gets embarrassed when I say this. I'm like, "You're my best friend." And she's like, "It's very sad that I'm your best friend, Holly." I'm like, "But you are." But we, in terms of that conversation, it was lovely. She got upset by the conversation, which I think is understandable. And I think I'm just like, she blames herself, which is probably, I mean, I don't have kids, but you may relate to this, like your child's sadness probably feel responsible for. I don't know.
Yeah, of course, because they're genetically half of you.
Yeah.
So you actually do feel their stuff.
And I remember my mum always said, which I've like carried as this great guilt, which we'll probably come to later, but she always said growing up, "You're only as happy as your unhappiest child." Which I'm sure is true as a parent, and hopefully when I have children I can experience that for myself. Well, not hopefully, I'm sure I will experience that for myself, but it makes me, or made me, and I'm still a bit like this, not want to share my struggles because I didn't want to make her sad.
It's an interesting sentence because there's two views on that. One saying I'm super connected to you and I care about you and I love you very much. But then for the younger one, it's like, "Oh shit, I'm responsible for your feelings now." Yeah. So I've now got to be a certain way, right?
Yeah.
Is that why you went into therapy?
I went into therapy when I was 18 initially, when my real father was diagnosed with cancer. And I found out in quite a weird way, like through my grandmother, and his side of the family are just like emotionally inept. I think it's fair to say there's not many of them left. So I think that's fine to say. And I found out in a letter from my grandmother, and I didn't find out from him. And my mother was away when I found out, and I was on my way back to school to finish, I think, my last term or last two terms of upper sixth. And I kind of went, I just freaked out and I didn't really know how to deal with it. I don't think anyone really knew how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And my mother and the school organized for me to start seeing a therapist. And I was actually thinking about this the other day. I have no memory of that. I don't remember anything. I couldn't tell you if it was a man or a woman. I couldn't tell you what we spoke about. I just know that I would go into my housemistress's like living room once a week and speak to someone, and I've got no memory of it. It's really weird.
Do you think that's because it's trauma based?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing I remember about that time is coming back and I ran a bath and I forgot about it and I flooded my corridor that I was at boarding school. I flooded the corridor, and I remember like being shouted at by like a deputy and da da da. And I, ever since I've had something sad happen, my gut is to run a bath. It's all really weird.
No, it's not. I think stuff like
it's about cleansing or something. Yeah. And then that was like my first time in therapy. And then when I was at university, when I was 21, my father died, and I hadn't spoken to him for maybe a year or two. And I hadn't seen him for a few years. I think the last time I saw him, I was like 18, because he lived in America at that point and was remarried. And I would go out every, until I was 18, I had to see him. I had, like, legally, I don't really know. I had to go out there. And one summer I came back and I just like broke down to my mom, and I was like, I don't want to go back. And she was like, you don't have to. She was like, you're 18 next summer, you don't have to. And I didn't. And then he died a few years later, and I started having panic attacks. And that was in 2011, it must have been. And it's just like panic attacks just weren't spoken about. I thought I was having a heart attack.
They are horrendous for those who haven't had them.
Yeah.
I remember having my first one, and I was literally on all fours, had no idea what was going on. Found a brown bag, literally, and started to breathe in it, because I've seen it on TV, even though I didn't know what it actually was. They're awful.
Hideous. And I had never heard of one. And I was like, I think I was on my way to a lecture as it happened. Anyway, then I went back into therapy, and I had a terrible therapist organised by the university doctor, and I didn't get on with. And then opened up to my mother about what I was going through, and she found this incredible therapist back where my parents are. So I saw her a lot, and I think I saw her for about 10 years.
When you find a good one, yeah, you should keep
hold on
them.
To them. Hold on to them.
I think that's the funny thing about when I was growing up as well, that therapy was an American thing only for rich families in Dallas or in Hollywood that just needed an hour of something. When I first saw a therapist, I felt really like I must be broken, like there's something wrong with me. And I think because I traveled a lot and I lived in America a lot, I was like, but it's normal, but it's still a weird thing. But I found it so relieving to be able to just talk to people, you know.
Unbelievable. Like, it really is. And I was so ashamed. I used to, like, lie about... I didn't tell people I had a therapist. I didn't tell people that I was on antidepressants. I didn't... Like, it was such a secret thing of mine, because it, like you just said, like, I thought I was, like, defective.
Probably a third of the schools as well at the time.
Yeah. So yeah, I think there was a lot of shame, which just thank God doesn't exist today with things like that. So much. I'm sure people still have it, but.
Were you introduced to alcohol early on in your life?
Yes, very much so. But like in a very positive social
like
way.
Like a French lunch thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember like our parents putting water and wine, or like wine in a bit of water when we were little, like really little. I don't know what age. I'm like, I remember my brother, I actually don't remember this, but I remember the story of it. And he was like plunging his fist into a jug of Pimm's at my mother's like 35th birthday and got drunk. And it was such a funny story. And he was like four. And my parents were very sociable. And yeah, I was introduced to it very early, but as I say, in a positive way.
Yeah, and there is a positive way of doing it when you're younger.
Yeah.
Until you have problems later. And how did that manifest in your life? Because you just explained therapy and stuff, so there's already things going on.
Yeah.
How did alcohol change for you?
It was, for me, like a neutralizer. I had like so much anxiety and fear and a head that did not stop, like constant thoughts of like self-doubt, questioning everything, questioning myself. Am I having fun? Is the person talking to me having a good time? Alcohol was just like, whoop, all of that went away. I was like, this is a miracle.
Did you have a realization about that?
I don't know if I did. It's interesting you asked that. I don't know if I did until hindsight.
Yeah.
I just loved it. And I was like, a big drinker and a good, like, a fun time girl. Yeah. Like, I loved it, and it was a lot of fun until it wasn't.
It's funny, if you suffer from stuff like that, and a lot of people in this area say about their overthinking, their sensitivity, and probably if you read about your upbringing, you'd think, she can't have any problems.
Yeah.
Everything must be fine. Where do you think that comes from?
Oof. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out, but at the same time, almost like not trying to overthink it.
Yeah.
Does it matter? Mm. Like, is how I kind of think about it. There is a quite clear history of issues with alcohol that run through my family. My mother's mother died because of alcoholism. I think my stepfather's mother did as well. Not that that's blood related, but there is a clear line of issues genetically. Do I think I was born with this? I don't know. Maybe. I try not to think about it. What do you think? Do you think you were born an alcoholic?
It's a really good question. Well, I was thinking more about the thinking stuff that people that have alcoholism seem to have early on in life, like overthinking, oversensitivity. An asset if you use it properly, like reading the room, understanding personalities on different levels and layers. I think I was. We had it in our family as well. And we've had a couple of people on, Dr. Ryan Zafari, who said that basically you can predict it in a nine-year-old boy at the thickness of the front lobe.
Wow.
And also there has to be 19 genetic different components, exactly the 19, that have to be, I'm going to use the word misfiring, which is wrong, or misaligned, whatever it is, that can predict it as well. So there's definitely something there.
Interesting. The thing that makes me think I probably was is that when I'm in a 12-step fellowship, and the similarities in the way we all think and things we did as children and coping mechanisms and masking and this and that, I'm like, there's got to be something there, guys.
Yeah.
Like, we're all cut from the same cloth here.
Yeah.
So I guess that side of it.
That's interesting. I've not thought about that because I'm not into football, but you get all, like, say, Manchester United fans, put them in a room and they are ching all together, talking about the same subject, doing the same thing. And it's kind of like that, isn't it? In a fellowship. As you've gone from teenager through the therapy, upper six, when did you start going into fashion, and have you always wanted to be in the fashion industry?
Always. It's all I ever wanted to do. I was like, I was quite horsey growing up, but I don't like to admit to that too much. I was either, when I was like, you know, when children are like, I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that, I'm going to be a 3-day eventer or an artist or a fashion designer. I didn't ever really want to be a fashion designer. I just knew I wanted to be in that world. And when did I start? When I was 16, I did my first internship. Let's not call it an internship. Work experience. I did a week of work experience.
Internship sounds better.
It does. I did a week of work experience with an incredible stylist.
How did you get to know them? A connection.
Family connection.
Okay, fine.
And so, like, a little bit of nepotism got me in the door. I did my work experience. I was like, this is incredible. The stylist I was working for at the time was styling Coldplay for their Viva La Vida tour when they were in all the amazing, like...
So you went straight in at the top.
Yeah, and I was like, this... But I wasn't even doing any of the glamorous side of it. I didn't meet any of them. I was in her home in Ladbroke Grove, and... she had no food in the house, and I would be like shut in there, and I couldn't leave because she didn't leave me with a key, and the door was shut on latch.
Oh,
so I was like starving. All she had was like Ribena. So I was just drinking Ribena. I know, so unhealthy.
With an iron and the steam and...
Not even. I was just packing up post-fitting, and there were like thousands of shirts. And I now to this day, I'm like, that's where my ability to fold a shirt comes from. I was just folding shirts and putting them back, and then like hand carrying things back to like Tiffany on Sloane Street, and like I had an A to Z to get around.
I still have one in my car, literally.
So sweet. And I just thought this was the coolest thing in the world.
So just for people who don't know, a stylist, when I think of a stylist, I'm like this glamorous person that just wafts in with like suitcases where someone else is carrying them and stuff. But actually, it's really hard work.
It's really hard work.
What do you actually have to do for those people who don't know?
So I was actually laughing with someone about this at a dinner the other day. I was like, we're not really stylists. Like most of the time, we're just like... courier coordinators. I feel like 90% of what I do in a day is like tracking down a missing sample, sending back something, or like on the phone to FedEx being like, please release look 22. But to answer your question properly, so I'm now more of a celebrity stylist. Previously I was fashion editor, which is same but different. So I was the fashion editor side of things. You're in-house with a magazine, you are coming up with the concepts for the big fashion editorials, the cover images you see, you're choosing your teams. It depends on the size of the magazine. Some magazines, they have someone who does all of those things. In my last few years in magazines, we were a much smaller team, so I was doing all of that. Coming up with the concept, choosing the location, choosing the models, requesting, choosing the clothes that are going to be in that editorial, sourcing them, getting to the shoot. So there's a lot of unglamorous bit that happens for like 10% of glamour.
Yeah.
Which is...
Same for a model, right? Same for photographer, no?
Maybe. I'd say it's like...
Let me sell it to you. So...
You're
on a restricted food plan, gym four times a week.
Yeah.
You have no say in that. You might get a phone call and go, oh, I'm talking about in past tense, obviously. You might have a phone call saying, tomorrow morning you're going to Milan. And then when you get to Milan, you're there and you're like, great, I can go home tomorrow. Oh, there's a shoot in LA. Go and do that. So you've got to get more clothes, go to LA. So it can be a lot behind the scenes that you invest in the final picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have I sold it or not? Kind of.
Yeah.
Maybe
a little. Yeah. But no.
And knocking on doors and trying to get jobs in the first place for hours and hours and hours. Yeah.
Yeah. Huge. Which is now, I'm more that side of it in terms of I'm now freelance and have been for 5-6 years, and if not longer, and it's. Yeah, waiting for jobs. And you have, now I'm celebrity side, which is amazing. And I have regular clients and I have my little bank of actors that I work with and love. But if they're not promoting something, if they're off filming for 6 months, you're not working with them. Because I do the red carpets, the photo shoots, the press interviews, the events. I have nothing to do with them when they're on a film. So when they're away filming, I'm just like waiting for them to come back so we can work together. So it is.
It's an important relationship. It's a very important relationship, stylist to a celebrity or model, whoever they're working with, because there's so much trust.
Yeah.
It's quite an intimate thing. I was talking about this to someone recently that, you know, you'll be, not always, but you'll be getting changed in front of them just to try it on and say, oh, let's just try this on and stuff. And you're at your most vulnerable because you either half naked and the conversations there, and it's really I remember working with you, it's etiquette is a really, really good thing, because some people just stand there looking whilst you're doing it instead of turning, walking around, conversing about something else or getting on with something, right? So you have to be really good at what you do to be a celebrity stylist.
Yeah.
Like really. And it's the nuances.
Yeah, gotcha. And reading them, like you said, I do think like the anxiety and the negative side of that. Not the negative side of that, sorry. The positive side of like being able to read a room really quickly is so important, because people don't always say what they really mean, but I can read it.
And if you
have a client who's uncomfortable, and it might be because someone is hovering in the room, like a publicist or a, I don't know, whatever, but, you know, and you have to be that person. You're kind of like, I do feel really protective over my clients.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of like younger guys as well who are like, just incredible and doing amazing things, and I'm very protective over them. And like, there have been situations where I've like asked a photographer to like leave, like, why are you standing in this room in front of this 25-year-old boy changing?
But that's the point, is that you have the agency to do that.
Yeah.
A through trust and building trust. And this is the positive thing about what we're talking about, having addiction, that mind where you can read a situation, not the front print. So someone might say something, but you know exactly they mean the opposite or different.
Yeah.
It's a real good asset to have,
it
right?
It is.
When did you feel that alcohol started to take a toll?
Oof. I would say there have been situations throughout, I mean, there have been consequences from the word go in terms of, not the word go, maybe from my 20s onwards, when I started working more seriously, when I moved from like fashion assistant to fashion editor, and I was full-time in a magazine, and we were working really hard and playing really hard. And that were, you know, like coming in late to work, missing work, lying, saying you know, it's not great in your at like a fairly serious level. So there were times like that, but they were peppered. It was not continuous. It was like the odd occasion here and there, and some things I'm, you know, times I'm really not proud of. I like slept through an alarm for a, I feel sick saying this. Slept through an alarm for a campaign shoot. It was like a 3-day job, and it went through onto the Saturday, and on the Friday night I went out and I was like, I've got this like big gig tomorrow. I've got this big gig tomorrow. And the wheels came off, and I woke up at like midday to like 10,000 missed calls from the art director and the photographer. And they just had to start shooting.
How did you feel in that moment?
Oh, I wanted to die.
Yeah.
I wanted to die. And then I like got my, and I had all the clothes. Do you know what I mean? It's not.
Oh, you missed that part.
Yeah, I had all the clothes.
Oh, wow.
So okay. Like the, it was a talent, not like, he wasn't anyone particularly famous, but there was like, they were using like regular people, and he just had come in a decent enough outfit for it to be shot. It was for a shoe brand. And I had to arrive, and no one was speaking to me. And I'm not surprised. They were fucking furious at me. Yeah. But the shame of that, I mean, it still makes me feel sick. And that was at least 10 years ago, probably.
Did that experience stop you from going out for a while?
No. No. I probably went out that night because of the, like, the shame. But listen, so there were, like, peppered times throughout life. I would say post the last 2 years before I got sober were the worst.
Why? Why were they the worst?
Why were they the worst?
I can tell you why mine was the worst.
Please do.
So I come from a sporting background as well, yeah. Right? And I was never going to drink ever. And I just loved to ride bikes, to run. I was a gymnast, did trampolining, did football. That wasn't good, didn't do that good. Boxed very well, just loved doing stuff.
Mm.
And coped at quite a high frequency, never really at depth. Even though I had it, I just didn't do well in social situations. And but I loved being out, and I loved being with people. Even though I'm quite introvert, I still love being with people, mm-hmm. and I'm a team player. But what happened in the end was that everything that I felt that alcohol gave me, bravado, made me feel good looking, because I didn't feel like that myself, made me feel taller, stronger, funnier, I still laugh at my own jokes, it took it all away. And I was on like a 3-day loop, so I would go out like you just said. Sometimes I would try to wait to the end of a shoot, but sometimes would not if everyone else was drinking. And I would have this kind of thing where I'd do the emergency thing, like down a pint of water before, or eat some bread before. And then in the morning before, if I could remember, I would down a litre of water before I went to bed, just try and manage in this thing, which sounds crazy now to me, but try to manage it, take like Baroccas and different things. Obviously never worked, made me feel like I was doing something, probably just take away the shame. But I was on like a 3-day loop in the end. And I couldn't go past 2 or 3 days. I'd feel awful. And I'd be like, oh my God, I am not doing that again. Literally not doing that again. And then it would just, something would change inside me. I'm like, I'm just going to have a just going to have a beer or something with the guys. And it's like the memory is wiped off. Hi, it's Paul here. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you for listening. I'm genuinely grateful to have you with us. If something you've heard today has resonated with you, I'd love to ask you a small favour. Think of one person in your life who might need to hear this conversation right now, then send it to them. One message, one share, you never know how much it could mean to someone who's struggling. And if you're enjoying This Is Powerful, follow the podcast and leave a rating or review. It really, really helps more people to discover these conversations. And now back to my conversation with Holly.
I mean, mine was the last 2 years. I think what you said about like all those things you were like loved and were good at and that sort of going, I think it like zapped me of my ambition. I was like just, it's a funny one because I was technically having more success than I'd ever had. I had a superstar client who was like the face of the moment. I was flying all over the world, shooting campaigns with him, doing big press tours with him. And my work was being seen everywhere. I was, as I said, like technically having the best time I'd ever had in my career. But with that came also quite a lot of like scrutiny and like the social media side of stuff. Like I got very into seeing what people thought about what I had put this person in. And to someone who's not in fashion, that's probably like, oh my God, you're so self-absorbed. But it is like something creative and it's like, I don't know, the artists are now going to kill me. But like, if you're an artist, you like put your work out on display and you like open yourself up for critique. And the people I work with have like, some of them have like really crazy fans. And I would just like put someone in something, they'd go to an event and I would like lie in my living room, like scrolling and looking at people, like just destroy what he was wearing. Or I know it sounds a bit ridiculous, but I was getting more and more insecure. I had more and more self-doubt, even though on the outside it looked like I was like having this incredible few years of work. I was also like newly engaged. Like everything looked its best inside. I had never felt worse. And I just felt like I was just like going through the motions or like living in this parallel universe of like getting up, doing the thing. And I was completely reliant on alcohol to do anything.
Anything.
It was hideous. Hideous.
Did anyone say anything to you at the time?
I know everyone says this and people are like, you're not, you know, you weren't such a good liar. Like everyone kind of knew, but I was pretty sneaky. Like I think I was quite good at hiding it. My now husband, he knew. He knew. But if he confronted me, I would blow up and
do the diversion trick.
Yeah. How dare you? And I think he was maybe the only one that said something. I don't ever remember anyone else saying anything.
When we did maybe our first shoot for the magazine, he was editor at, I don't know if he was drinking then, but I did not know if you were, because you was really polite, incredibly professional, great at your job.
I wouldn't have thought I was.
It didn't seem like it to me.
Is that the motorbike one? Or the car one?
No, there was one before. Motorbike one, though. I think it was before that.
That I remember we were drinking at lunch. Not heavily, though.
Yeah.
But I didn't know. That was before things took off for me. No, no, no. No way. No.
After your husband had rightly said stuff, how long before you decided that I need to make a change?
I think it was maybe 6 or something months. It was like a while. So I was actually thinking about this on the way here. So I sent you a voice note. We had had a conversation. I remember it. We were sat on my sofa. We'd had a conversation, him and I, and I was like, I think I'm going to explore these meetings that people talk about. And he was like, amazing, great. And I sent you a voice note. And then I woke up in the morning and I saw you hadn't read it and I deleted it. I was so ashamed. I deleted it and then went back to normal programming. And I just like shut everything out. And I would do these like quite like dramatic gestures. Like I'd empty all the alcohol out in the house and send him a picture and be like, I've just thrown all of this away. Do you know?
Yeah.
I've signed up to a new gym and I'm going to do Pilates every morning and I'm doing a green juice cleanse. Like anything to not do the work.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And then eventually I had a particularly like alcohol-fueled work trip and I just came back and was like, enough's enough. And that's when I called you, I think, again. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a friend, mutual friend of ours as well, who's sober, and walked into my first meeting. And that, the rest is history.
Yeah. Do you think in... People always ask me that they believe that the fashion and film industry is full of drugs, full of alcohol, full of craziness. What's your experience? Because for me, I felt like it. I mean, I'm out of it now anyway, in the sense of I'm drunk for so long. So I wouldn't know those little bits and pieces that go on. But it was in the 90s and 2000s, it was pretty much nuts. And then calmed down a bit. But I know when I got sober, there was a few guys I used to work with that were still doing that. Do you think there's pressures in that business to drink?
I think it's there if you want it. I don't think it's... So I'm a little bit younger than you.
You could be my daughter, I think, couldn't you?
No. That would be quite young. Okay, you'd have to have been quite young. But so I think by the time I went into the industry, it wasn't as wild. Like there were times that you would drink at lunch, but that was a rarity, not you. Like, and that would be like on an editorial and the photographer had got booze in at lunch. There was a lot of like a shoot wrapping and going for drinks. Aside from that, it's like the parties and things outside of it. That, yeah, it's prevalent, but it's only prevalent if you want it. And like, actually, when I got sober, I was like, oh, I can't. I've got to still go to things. Otherwise, I'm going to be irrelevant and no one's going to work with me. And I remember going to this dinner and looking around and being like, oh, people really aren't drinking that much.
Yeah.
And actually, I would have just found the naughty gang in the smoking area and we would have run around and probably gone to something completely unrelated to that work event and I just had the association. Do you know what I mean? We were probably just in some like crusty bar in Soho.
Yeah, that's so well said, because it is true. That's what happened when I first come back into the business. I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm you know, they're going to crack the wine open in a minute. There's going to be champagne. Someone's going to get something else. It's going to be a nightmare. And I remember having my hair done, just dying in the chair. I was so nervous. I was genuinely nervous. And the person doing my hair said something like, what do you want to have done? And I was like, I don't know, just maybe a trim. Just like, should we keep it simple? And I went, do you go to meetings? She's like, yes. And I was like, oh my God. And I thought this person was like crazy, but she was just fun and happy. And then someone else on the shoot was sober too, and I was like, wow. Then I found this whole network and I was like, oh, it's not as mad as I thought it was. Yeah. Actually,
I think that the side of things I do now is really not either. Like, you have to be on your A game 24/7. Yeah. And it's just not that. I do look back on, like, I mean, I would have gone to like the opening of a shoebox in my 20s. Like, we got so many invitations to fun things, and there was like, I had a lot of friends in the industry at that time and we would run around and we would go to everything and it was...
And it is fun when you're young.
It's really fun when you're young. And those shoots abroad when you're young.
Yeah.
Like, for me, I just feel like everything happened at the right time. Like, alcohol didn't have a grip on me the way it did in my 30s. So, like, in my 20s, like, running around. I had this great job. I mean, slightly mad job, but like great job. And we were running around all over the world with fabulous people and photographers and models like yourself. And we were just having a lot of fun. If I was doing that, if I like now, that would probably not be that conducive to my lifestyle. But
in saying that, I've been on some really nice shoots, especially like the one we did, the motorbike shoot.
Yeah.
Apart from there was an accident, there was someone else's fault on there. But but it's jobs like that where everyone's lovely and fun and bloody good at what they do. So everyone knows what they're doing. You don't have to ask for stuff. You just offer it up. Do you want me to do this? Shall I do that? That was really magical for me, that shoot, because I felt like I was alive. Sober, clear-minded, everyone's nice, it's fun, I know exactly what I'm doing, I'm not hungover, I'm not thinking that you think I'm something, or I'm not thinking that they think I've got this. And the freedom of that, it was just, it's just incredible.
Yeah, that was one of my like favorite shoots actually at that time. I just remember sitting around and you were telling us so many stories, like wild stories, and we all just sat, we were like, tell us another one, Paul, of like modeling in the 90s and like all the crazy things you got up to. But do you know what's so interesting is that, so we had a few interactions over the years, and then like working together, being at the same parties, we were at a job, not a job, we're at a party, I can't remember the name of the brand. I just had a breakup, and had a girlfriend was at mine, like consoling me. And I was like, oh, I forgot there's this party at Lulu's, 5 Hartford Street. Mm-hmm. Do you remember this?
By the giraffe downstairs?
Yes.
No?
What?
Yeah, go on.
I was like, wait, what? And my friend was like, oh, let's just go. Like, and I was like, it's Tuesday night, like whatever. And we went, got dressed up, and there was a really fun group of like you and like some other of the select guys, and we had so much fun. And I remember being like, can I get everyone a drink? Everyone was like, yeah, this or that, beer or vodka or whatever. And you went, can I have a soda with a slice of lime in it, or a tonic with a slice of lime, or lemon? And I was like, I remember going downstairs and ordering the drinks and being like really clocking that and being like, this guy's out at 1 a.m, midnight, like dancing, chatting. And he's I don't know. It just stayed with me forever. It will always stay with me. And that's how I knew to call you when I needed. I don't know.
It really touched me because I never knew that.
No, did you not know that? No. Yeah.
It's the first time you said it.
Yeah. It's stayed with me forever. I was like, oh, because I think the biggest misconception as well is that like your life as you know it and fun ends if you get sober. I certainly felt that. I remember my first Friday sober, and I'd been at a meeting in Soho, and I cried walking through Soho to get on the tube because I was like, life as I know it is over. I am no longer this fun person that you can call on a Tuesday lunch for a drink or like invite last minute to a party on a Friday. And I had no idea that actually, like, my life was about to begin again. And that you can, this is so cheesy, but, like, you can dance sober. Yeah. And you can party and you can stay out till the best of them. But you'll stay because you're having a really good time with really good people. You're not, like, wasting nights on, like, shitty people with crap music.
Which is really important to say, because I thought my life was over.
Yeah.
Thought I'm done. Like, I would never have fun again. And the first time, I was really nervous going out the first time because I wasn't sure about it and I was worried about it. But what I found was that I belly laughed for the first time.
Yeah.
And I thought I was laughing before, but it was kind of, it wasn't put on, but it was enhanced and whatever, fueled with alcohol. And it was more about being funny or laughing rather than the reality of the situation, enjoying the company. And when I first belly laughed, it actually shocked me. I was like, oh, that was actually a real laugh. And it was really lovely. And I think the freedom of going out, enjoying the music, the company, maybe getting dressed up nice.
Yeah.
But also knowing that at any time I wish to go, I can drive myself home, I can get home safely. And also it's just nice, I don't know about you, but I liked to be very unpresent before, and I like to be very present. and watch people, see what's going on, read the room in a nice way, and just take it all in.
Yeah.
Where before you're like, it's just you and the other person, and that's it. Yeah. And it's like in the corner, like, shall we go to the bathroom? Or sure, we're like, where are we going next? And you think you're a legend.
Yeah. And you're having this like really intense connections. Yeah. And like, but you're not. You're just like, I probably was like, oh, and then my father died. And da-da. Do you know what I mean? Like, really vacuous. Not that that's vacuous, but like.
No, but in the faux way.
Faux connection, whereas now I feel like, also I was, this probably doesn't paint me in a very good light, but like I just wanted to be having fun all the time, and I wanted to be with the funnest people and having the funnest time, like having the most fun. And people that I would have looked at now then and been like, oh, they're a bit boring, like I hope I'm not sat next to them. Now if I'm like at a work event or something, like anyone I'm sat next to, I can have like a really lovely conversation with, and like learning that not everything has to be fun all the time was like a really, you can just walk away and be like, God, that was such an interesting conversation I had with that person.
That's like a coping mechanism to escape. So realizing you don't have to escape in that way is pretty incredible.
If
there's any younger people in the business that are struggling, or they think that they have to drink to go to places, like what you said earlier, or I have to go to this event and stuff, what advice would you give them?
Oh my gosh. I would say you will not become irrelevant if you say no to an event. I would say in my early sobriety, maybe that first like 3 to 6 months, I didn't need to go to the things I went to, and I maybe put myself in a slightly more vulnerable situation than I needed to. Avoid places that are triggering to begin with. It's not forever. It's just while you're particularly new and vulnerable. And then when you feel like safe enough to start going to things, this is again maybe a bit cheesy, but I always say this to like young women that I meet in the rooms, like glamorize getting ready, because sometimes that's, you're going to spend longer doing that than you will at the event. Like, take your time, like make your little evening get ready session a, I don't know, like.
Well, it's a bit like a self-worth pampering session before,
like,
you go
out,
right?
And a bit of self-care and like, just, you know, have a kombucha or whatever it is you drink, a sparkling water with a slice of lemon in it and put some music on, have a nice time, go early, get yourself there near the beginning. And if you're filled with fear, get out. And no one notices when you leave. No one.
That is brilliant advice.
I hope so. I would also say, this maybe isn't advice, but the whole industry is a melting pot or like breeding ground for insecurity, I think. And that doesn't go just because you're sober.
Yeah.
Where am I going with this? I don't know. I was just thinking about it on the way here. I was like, well, I still feel a lot of anxiety. That doesn't go. You just have tools now with which to cope, and healthy tools with which to cope.
Yeah, I think that's really well said, because it is a breeding place for anxiety, because it's all about the finished product, how fast to get there, how well put together it is. We're all kind of cap in hand to the final result, so it's like you got to be your best, you got to be pleasing everybody. You're running around really like sort of like cap in hand in a way, where you're a slave to what's going on.
Yeah,
and everyone does it, and the energy is like that. It's like, we've got to get it done no matter what, we have to get it done, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. But that does breed that, even for like as a model, especially guys, like you have to be super body conscious, which I think I'm over now, but you have to be super body conscious, and you know, and the slightest thing can make you feel gross, or if someone says something, and maybe it's the same with a stylist, someone's like, I'm not sure about this outfit, or I'm not sure about that one, you might be thinking about it for months to put it together.
Well, I do not know how you guys do it. I don't know how models do it, and I don't know how actors do it, because the rejection and the critique would destroy me. But so hats off to you. But for me, it's more there's moments like that, obviously, like if someone doesn't like something you've done, like that's a bit like that. But it's more the compare and contrast that comes from my peers, like seeing what other people are doing. And everyone paints the best pictures of themselves online. Yes. And I try and say that to like assistants that I work with. I'm like, no one's really doing like that amazing shoot that someone's just done. No one got paid for it. Like, don't think like it might look nice, but don't
think everyone got 100 grand each for it.
And, like, probably no one got paid. Like, or someone might put something up and actually it was from 5 years ago, but it's in, you know, so they're posting it in January when no one else is working, so everyone's freaking out that and I think find pockets of people you trust within the industry and peers. I have a handful of stylists who are like, instead of being pitted against each other, we've become really good friends, and that's so nice. And I can ring them and be like, you won't believe like this email I've got, and they can be like, oh, I've had that. And in the same way that like you and I in our sobriety have other sober people that we can call, and like it right sizes our problems, like finding a little pocket of good people in the industry that you can trust would be my advice.
Yeah, that's perfect. Holly, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation UK, which educates the public about addiction, recovery, and the wealth of surrounding issues. We use lived experience and evidence-based science to support those in recovery and those struggling with addiction. To find out more about what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate, please donate. It really, really helps us to put this on for you guys. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction. It will also help us to educate more of the population, and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you. See you next time.